This is the Infotagen podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. When Sir Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web, it was intended for everyone. But today it seems increasingly dominated by a few big tech companies who have accumulated huge amounts of data, data which shapes what we see online, including social media disinformation. So Tim has decided to make a change by launching Solid, an open source platform built to decentralize the web and give citizens more power over who has access to their data. Alongside this, they have created a new business called Inrupt to design and deliver new services built from this technology. I'm Damien Collins, and today I'm joined by Davi Ottenheimer, VP for Trust and Digital Ethics at Inrupt, based in Boston, Massachusetts, to discuss these projects. And we'll be hearing as well from our resident expert, the disinformation analyst, Dr. Charles Creel. Davi, thank you for taking part in the Infotagen podcast and joining us today. I was really interested to discuss on the podcast today the work that you guys are doing in Boston at Inrupt to try and recreate the way data works on the web. Because on the podcast series so far, we've often talked about people's personal data in the context of the coronavirus, and in particular, the various apps that different governments and health authorities have launched to try and help defeat the virus. And indeed, technology could be an important part of monitoring where coronavirus breaks out in the future, how we help people isolate or protect themselves from outbreaks of the virus. But for it to work properly, there needs to be a high level of public trust about how data is gathered, how it's used, how it could be used in the future. And so I thought that it was discussing the work that you and your team are doing would be particularly important. Perhaps just to start us off, for the benefit of the podcast listeners, you could explain just a little bit about what you do at Inrupt and the technology you're developing and how it could be used.
Sure, happy to. Thanks for having me here today. And really, it's an honor to be talking to you about this. It's not just in context of the pandemic, of course, it's in context of every future pandemic or anything that could happen to a person. Solid is really a technology like the World Wide Web itself that's meant to be a standardized way of sharing information that respects the human condition. So it's meant to make the existing protocols, Solid's meant to make protocols that we have already started on and gone down the path of developing the web on, and make them more powerful in terms of having a single logon system, you know, some centralized way of representing yourself, but a decentralized way of owning the data. In other words, making it more centric to yourself and being able to represent yourself as the owner of your own identity. So you really end up controlling all of your data in a way that today is somewhat difficult because as an economics exercise, we've seen the shift towards very large engines that are representing you and serving you, but may not have your best interests in mind. And so the technology is the, you know, revamping this or taking a course correction, as we call it, is going to help us move that power shift back to the individual and away from the centralists.
And this is one of the issues that people who are interested in data policy have been talking about for years. How do we get to a system where people really can make their data work for them rather than just give it away as the price of accessing free services online?
Correct. I think the way I've tried to frame it in the past is that we've seen a shift, I think, due to the socioeconomic conditions of the market that wasn't necessarily going to happen, didn't have to happen. In other words, when we first started with the web, it was revolutionary in that you could put up a web server and publish content the way you could have a printing press and publish a leaflet. Like, you were able to generate your own content that you wanted about yourself, and you became very powerful in that sense in a revolutionary way. But along the path, there were just dynamics in the market to where the printing presses all got bought up and then provided to you, and you no longer had control of them. In order to communicate, you had to use one that was basically issued to you, and the content itself was essentially owned by someone else, even though it was yours and you were printing it. In the same way you might have seen in telecommunications, used to be able to, in the true history of hacking, the original hackers in my mind were the ranchers and the farmers who, when they had barbed wire, not many people realize this, but barbed wire was actually made out of the same galvanized steel that was used for the telegraphs. So they just simply like took it, extended the phone wires, and made their own phone networks. It was very upsetting to the telephone companies to have these people basically issuing their own telephone companies using the materials that were the same. So in the history of technology, you see this up-down balance where telephone companies want to be centralized, but then they get too centralized, then they get decentralized, broken up. And so what we're seeing, I think, is in terms of this over-centralization, something that is both natural because you have a back and forth, but also something that went too far and really shouldn't have gotten so centralized in such a dominant way. And we need to bring it back to the much more natural condition of rotating back towards the individual, because there's a much bigger market and much more innovation, and it's much better for both technology and people and the way that we represent ourselves.
Yeah, because I think we've, I think particularly since the Cambridge Analytica scandal, we've got used to thinking about and talking about a model of data whereby a big company like Facebook gathers as much data as it possibly can, and then says to you, well, because we've got this data, we can deliver more personal services to you, but only within Facebook itself. And the idea that instead of giving out that data away, that you holding that data and making it work for you is very different from that Facebook model. And do you think, I also think as well, I mean, we're told by companies like Facebook that you can download your data from them. You can see, you can get back the data that they hold on you, but that's often not that useful unless it can be applied in some way. And so is the idea of what you're working on at InRub that you can create, you know, you can create tools that allow people to make their data work for them?
Yeah, there's a lot of different angles to this because it's such a big topic. But I think to boil it down, here's a couple examples. If Facebook is a representation of you, if you think of your body, physical body, in digital terms, you have a digital body. And Facebook's representation of you is like having them take a picture of you, or which they literally do. They take a photograph and they put it into their servers, or a painter who paints a picture of you. That becomes an official representation of you in a very strange way, because that isn't you, that's their representation of you. But you want to own your own digital body. You don't want someone to say, this is who you are, and then to represent you to others without your consent and use the picture, you know, sell your picture, sell your digital body without your consent. And in a sense, what I've tried to explain to people is this, again, in historic terms, is like taking a body and selling it on a market the way that human exploitation works. And so the digital exploitation of the body is very dangerous. In other words, if you wanted to rotate that back, you would say to Facebook, hey, that's a picture of me. That's my picture. Give me my picture back. And in a real sense, let's take a retail experience, for example. If you went into a retailer and you said, I want you to know a lot about me, like filling out a form at the doctor's office, please fill out this form before we see you. You would say, here are the things I like. I like blues. I like blacks. I like this type of texture in my fabrics. And they would know that about you. But then a minute later, you'd say, you know what? I don't want you to know that about me anymore. I'm going to turn off that information so you no longer know that about me. Now present again the list of furniture. Why would you do that? I mean, for example, you might say that you're shopping for your wife, your friend, your brother, you know, your husband. You're representing yourself as someone other than yourself because you have an interest in just finding out things about a slight, a facet of yourself. You being able to turn that off is essential. But in a Facebook model, once you give that information over, it's stored by them and it represents you almost forever, and you have no way of getting it back. And that's super dangerous for many, many, many reasons. The integrity of your own identity and being able to own your own digital body is actually something that's steeped in, when you really look at feminist philosophy, for example, it's steeped in the ability to maintain power of the individual agency and control your own destiny. It becomes a human right, essentially, and it's a language of oppression. I mean, Facebook is speaking the language of oppression, and to me is carrying on a horrible tradition of oppression, and it's almost unchallenged because of the level of power that they've accumulated.
And this was, this I think principle was at the heart of part of the debate we had on the NHS COVID app in the UK, because the government wanted to gather people's data once they reported that they believed they had coronavirus, but then not give that data back, to effectively keep that data for 20 years and use that for further research to develop NHS services. And that was different to the approach taken in other countries. In Australia, for example, they wanted to get people would give their data up to help the fight against the virus, but at the end of the pandemic, all the data was going to be destroyed. And it seems your model is more like that model, that people can choose to share their data with different providers to get a benefit for them, access to a service or a tool or a product that they find useful. But if they decide they don't want to share that data anymore, they can just turn it off.
That's right. There are two core concepts in the technology that over a decade now, I've been working on big data security risks. I started, for 1999 to 2009, I worked on a lot of cloud architecture risks. And then I realized the data on top of it had a whole nother layer of risks. And so for the last decade, I've been trying to figure out a way out of this much more complicated box of problems. And it really is wicked in its truest sense, but it comes down to if you can power off or you can reset these two button concepts we have in technology, then you're getting a long way towards being able to protect yourself. So if you get into a relationship with a robot, for example, if you can power off the robot, then you've accomplished something that protects you. Like if it's a vacuum cleaner and you can power it off, it's no longer sucking up things. You know when it's off. And that's important because engineers can build power off buttons and can measure whether it's working or not. I think it gets difficult when we try to bring social science concepts to engineers who don't have any background in it, no training in ethics, which is very common in computer science. It's very common in computer engineering that they have no concepts of the human condition or rights or responsibilities. In fact, I've started teaching computer science in graduate schools because I found so many engineers I was working with just thought if I make something and give it over to people, it's their responsibility to use it responsibly, and I have no responsibilities whatsoever, no matter what the harms. And that just really troubled me. So in other words, if I can go to engineers and say, if you don't build a power off button, this is not going to be a complete project. They understand that. And the other is if I say, you have to be able to allow people to reset from an integrity standpoint. If this is proven to be false, if this is proven to be something unwanted, confidentiality, for example, can be broken. Breaches can happen if you can't reset the data to a way that anonymous is a good example of this. If you can't reset the data to a way that doesn't represent you, then you're always exposed. You've given away the data and it's always going to be linked back to you in a way that you don't want. So that's why engineering, I think, has to be much more discreet because people aren't prepared. You can't tell them, make it ethical, make it safe. They don't understand. But if you tell them, make it something you can power off and make it something you can reset, they understand. Now, that's fundamental to the solid protocol in the sense that if you move data centricity towards the individual, they have a power off button and they have a reset button. So I can share with you the latest version of myself. This has other, like I said, it's a deep topic. This has other implications in that people can become something they weren't, but that's freedom. If I can reinvent myself, that is the cosmopolitan nature of cities. Essentially, we move from small villages into the city because we have an opportunity to move through communities and reinvent ourselves. And that's part of the freedom of cities that makes them so powerful. So I really feel like one of the challenges is that we've allowed technology firms to develop and expand and become powerful without being tied to the human condition. And that's very unfortunate. Many anthropologists would tell you that's impossible. Technology is always tied to the human condition. And so by not recognizing it, we've been complicit in allowing them to become extremely dangerous. And we need to sort of roll that back to where we start off with what's the impact of this technology? How does it appropriately represent our needs? So during a pandemic or during a COVID-19 situation, you have an epidemiologist who says, this is what I need my technology to do in order to be able to stop this virus spread. And then you would build the technology to that need. That's very different than Apple and Google getting together to create a framework, which is an API, where they say, we don't serve the scientific community. We're just infrastructure. It's a framework. And all the app developers that we're not connected to will figure it out in their communities. It's in such a disconnected fashion, we actually will probably see the opposite as we have in history, where there's going to be very dangerous apps, there's going to be very misleading apps, and then the question becomes, who's going to clean this up, and why should we trust it? You said you'd turn it off after 90 days, but you didn't, it's still on. Who's going to force you to turn it off? The power imbalances are just magnified.
And people, I mean, citizens generate lots of data with all the different services that they engage with, and the trouble is it's often not very well connected up. And in some ways, your earlier analogy about the Facebook holding your image, in some ways, the companies like Facebook are almost in a position of saying, well, you know, we are the only way you can really connect your data together. You know, we have to sort of tell you what you are and what you're like, because we're the only ones that can make any sense of it, even if you're not happy with that characterization. So it seems to me from the tools you're creating, it makes it much easier for people to bring together data that they create in different services that they use and put it all together in one place so that data can work harder. And also, but rather they have control over it rather than it just being given to another company to use.
Yeah. One of the craziest things I've ever heard is the Silicon Valley venture capitalists tend to talk about a moat, and they talk about it as a good thing, that if you get into a platform, there's a digital moat that prevents you from leaving. And that is not at all what moats are supposed to be. You go into a castle so that you're safe from attackers. The moat isn't supposed to prevent you from ever leaving the castle. But that's the way they describe it, because in their mind, if you can lock people in, you can extract them for wealth for a longer period of time. So you get more money because people are prisoners. And so that's kind of one of the fundamental misconceptions in a lot of the technology platforms, is the people funding it or backing it come at it from a power position of, how do I get people in that I can then lord over, almost in a feudal sense, in a completely reverse to what the actual analogies they're pulling up are saying, and not defending people from harm, but actually harming them. So when you have portability, and this goes back to HIPAA, I mean, even earlier in the 1970s, but in the 1990s, it was very clear we wanted portability in healthcare. So we created these sort of HIPAA things in the United States that said electronic records should move about. That's going to give us better services. And I think fundamentally, when you talk to people about portability, they agree with it. It's freedom. So are you allowed to leave your home? Are you allowed to leave your country? Can you change nations, like have a new citizenship? Could you change cities? Can you change even clothing? Can you leave things that you are in because you want to leave them behind? It's sort of so really fundamental to people's sense of freedom and liberty. And yet in the technology platforms, they've been just going down the opposite path. So I think a really good way of saying this is that it's a slippery slope. You know, there's a fallacy here that if you begin to allow people to move about, then anything's possible. It's much more, can you give people the portability they need fit to purpose? So in the case of a COVID-19, for example, could you give people the ability to share data in a way that's fit to solving the crisis? You know, 1854, 1856, 1850s were a seminal time for people figuring out germ theory, Dr. Snow and Semmelweis and a bunch of people. So they had the ability to move data around in a way that gave knowledge to people that really solved the crisis, not just invented concepts around germ theory, but they actually changed London fundamentally because they were able to make the political case for building a socialist concept of sewer systems. So data portability really comes to, how do we share knowledge in a way fit for purpose that allows us to understand the benefits to society because we've shared that knowledge that we would all agree to? That's really where we need to move towards, is not just sharing information or portability for the sake of it, not the fact that everything can move around freely, although that is good for the market because you'll have more apps and more sharing and more access. But actually, if we think about in this pandemic, what the goal of people is that we've essentially had elected or are supposed to represent us, they can't do their job unless they have the portability of the information. They're really hampered. And so we see a sort of crisis forming around the lock-in. It serves people who've locked them in because that's profits in their pockets, but it doesn't serve society. And that's the big imbalance. That's the big shift we have to work through.
And what's the time frame, do you think, for delivering this, or making this a kind of a reality for people? I know that the projects that your company is working on at the moment, can you give us a sense of things that you're doing at the moment that are live or about to go live, or how quickly you think this sort of approach could become mainstream?
We're already in process of deploying proof of concepts. We're already doing tests, and we're encouraging people to come on board and start to play with the technology. Solid itself as a concept is years old and has been around, but we're actually making it closer to where you get an actual service that you can run. Much in the same way the web really exploded when you had the web server and the web browser. That's really where we're going, with Solid being a solid service and a solid browser that allows people to then access the data or write apps on top of the protocol. So it's hard to predict how technology ramps, but we're already at the phase of we're getting people to write use cases, test cases, apps against the initial services. So we're very close to that first phase, and then how fast it goes from there is anyone's guess. It's much faster than we anticipated, that's for sure. You know, we thought there'd be more time, but I think the pandemic has put a lot of pressure on these solutions to move much, much faster. And I think also the recognition of the inequality in the platforms and the lack of action by the platforms. So many information platforms allowing misinformation, false information to spread comes back to the question of, why can't we have people who really have a grasp of how to solve that? I mean, there's so many social scientists and there's so many people in that field who are disconnected from the technology field. You know, there's a lot of Clint Watts out there that no one's ever heard of. So if we can give them the ability to generate information and build essentially their own platform or their own apps they don't have to be on Facebook, which lords over them. They don't have to be on a LinkedIn or a Twitter that really neutralizes or reduces their influence. Then we'd actually get an upspring of better content, better information. The same way you find a New York Times and a Washington Post can evolve because we have the printing press, as opposed to them being forced through some centralized singular voice of a nation. I mean, one of the weird things in history is you have 1934 in the United States, Roosevelt was like, we're going to decentralize communications. You know, the FCC was created essentially to fight Nazism. 1934 in Germany was when they centralized all the communications and nothing could be said without going through the funnel. So we're in an ahistoric mode right now. We've inverted, and the United States is building these like Facebook and Fox like centralized platforms, which was the exact opposite of what the FCC was supposed to be doing when it was created in 1934 to fight Nazism.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point. I wish to bring in Charles Creel as someone who looks out for, seeks and fights extremist content online.
Hi, Damien.
Charles, what's caught your eye in the last few days?
Well, it goes along very much with the conversation we're having today, because in the past I've talked about alternative social networks here. Specifically, I think I referred to Gab a couple times as Twitter for Nazis. But a new one has caught a lot of people's attention in the past few weeks. It's called Parler. That's P-A-R-L-E-R. French for talk. Parler is a Twitter-like social media platform, and it's being marketed specifically at political conservatives in the United States. It's being touted as a kind of free speech platform. Now, in America and conservative Republican circles, there's a lot of talk about Facebook and Twitter being censors of speech, particularly around incidents where Twitter is labeled Trump's tweets as misleading or Facebook is taken down as political ads and so on. And so there's a conservative reaction to these platforms of censorship. So Parler is supposed to be there and it's supposed to solve these perceived problems. They were founded in 2018, which is not very long, but they really got a lot of attention a couple weeks ago when news broke that Katie Hopkins, after being thrown off Twitter, had moved over to Parler. And now, if you don't know, Hopkins is the ex-Apprentice contestant in the UK who gained notoriety for spouting hate speech in print and over the airwaves. She's incited racial hatred messages, directed them at Stormzy, a persistent campaign against Meghan Markle, and lobbying invective at Black Lives Matter. But Twitter finally threw her off the platform, and this was for attacking victims of child sexual exploitation. And that they only did after a petition was raised against her. So it was then reported anyway that Hopkins moved to Parler and was using it to raise money on a crowdfunding website. But as it turned out, it was actually anonymous, or a claim from anonymous, that they had opened an account in her name, raised a few hundred dollars, and they were going to donate it to charity. But surreally, once the fake Hopkins account was taken down, then Hopkins opened her own real account on Parler. So anyway, as of last year, Parler said they had 100,000 users compared to Facebook's 2.5 billion. It's a drop in the bucket. But they got a good deal of traction when Trump campaign manager Brad Parscale joined, along with people like Milo Yiannopoulos. And the user base trebled in June 2019 with 200,000 signups from Saudi Arabia. Parler said those were the nationalist movement of the Saudis, but actually it also followed Twitter deactivating hundreds of accounts that were pushing Saudi government talking points. But recently, several right-wing conservative figures joined Parler, and that was mostly last month around the Hopkins PR. Donald Trump Jr., Rudy Giuliani, Alex Jones, and Ted Cruz. Now, I figure they might know who Hopkins is, but they might also not know who Hopkins is, and that there seems to be a push to pull more personalities on the sites. And with personalities like that, you might wonder what the day-to-day base is like. Well, it's mostly Donald Trump supporters, far-right, alt-right, conspiratorial, anti-Semitic, anti-feminist, a very typical group of people, and that at least according to their parlors, their equivalents of tweets. To kind of sum it up, New Statesman called it the echo chamber for hard-right views. that the new European said were the shrillest sounds reverberating into the void. That's our alternative social media network for the week, Parler.
Well, that's right. Well, as you know, we're not keen on echo chambers. So what I've done is I've created a Parler account for myself. So the same, and I've posted the link to the Infotagen podcasts on my first Parler on the site. So I thought that's my contribution to trying to crack their echo chamber to make sure that the Parler audience at least has access to the Infotagen podcast.
Terrific. Well, we should invite them to subscribe to the podcast now while they're here.
Exactly. They should follow up on that, and we might get an interesting new element to the audience.
One of the best examples of this is Sacha Baron Cohen, who, as a comedian, as an exercise, as sort of a court jester, goes in and tests the limits of people's ability to accept him. So he disguises himself and tries to enter communities and then push them as far as they can possibly go. And that's why it's interesting when he comes out and says, this is not acceptable. I'm a limited speech advocate. I want speech to be stopped, even though I'm the person who's pushing. He's a classic hacker in the sense that he's like, how far outside of the periphery can I go? How much can I push these controls open? So he's the perfect candidate to get onto these platforms and then make them as crazy as he possibly can and then say that shouldn't be allowed.
Well,
even extremist communities have a limit.
It's a really valid point that, you know, free speech always operates within context. And unless you're trying to promote the most incendiary free speech, then typically that's taken as a given.
Yeah, it's bizarre to me, too, that people often think that there is this absolute speech right. It doesn't exist, and it's been repeatedly proven by the courts, and there's, you know, a pyramid of harms. And once you get to a point where it's really violent and dangerous and toxic, then it needs to be shut down. And on a more distributed platform basis, you would have individual people who are looking more closely at the content. Scientists would look at content and they'd say, this is unscientific or this is lies. And they would remove it because they have an obligation to keep their platform for science, you know, clear and clean. And that would be true for every community, that they would be self-policing better if they had a more distributed model of information. And everyone has a limit that's too extreme that they would regulate. So there's no free, completely free speech platform in that sense.
Just one question, if I could. I'm really interested to know, once we have, or should we, move to a model where people's data and the kinds of personality profiles that are drawn on them are much more controlled by the individual and so on, what happens with all the legacy data and what happens with all the legacy personality profiles that have been developed over these years when it's basically been the Wild West out there?
It's a super complicated question, not only because we have shared ownership. So we have a single identity that splits into two, which would be like a married couple that gets divorced. We also have people who have passed away. So who is the guardian of information that's been left behind by people who are no longer alive? That kind of thing. So how that pans out is not exactly clear. And there are actually protocols now for archive it themselves. So there's a perfect example of where technology has to represent the human condition. And what it'll probably be is a number of sliders and switches. So where you get it wrong, you would be able to reset it. And where you thought it was just completely useless, there's a duplicate or it no longer needs to be available to people, it should be turned off. That's the power button. Or it should be kept in a particular place where it's in context, as opposed to spread around liberally where it's taken out of context. The technology has to represent those types of decisions. The people who are best at making those decisions are skilled in critical analysis, critical thought. So historians, for example, you walk into a library, there's 10 million books, or if you get on the internet, there's a billion web pages. How do you make sense of it? Historians are meant to go in, look at all the books, pick two or three and say, these are the definitive voices. Maybe there's not one voice because everyone was in the same situation. Everyone had different perspectives. So we have three perspectives as a final tally, and these are the most accurate perspectives of that. So the technology has to represent, right, where the archive, a library as an archive, where the library is, how people get into it, which things they're able to read, which things are considered the more authoritative. That's just classic, you know, critical analysis, critical thought that comes from the humanities, social sciences.
Yeah, but it's in that today, though, in the public realm, public speech, political speech, that role has been devolved to the sort of Facebook algorithm and other such tools, because it is that algorithm which is decided. It's that algorithm which is deciding which speech is more important than other speech, which speech to be heard by more people, and creating an audience for hate speech.
but this is such a pet peeve of mine. It's like when Uber said our prices were jacked up during terrorist threats or bombings in Australia because of the algorithm, as if it was a disembodied thing on its own that it was deciding. You know, so much of what my research has been in AI especially has been to try to prove that there is a accountability threat, essentially, that the humans created this thing that then behaves in a certain way and they need to treat it as such. So if I create a tool, I need to make it hard to misuse, you know, put a safety on, put a seatbelt in a car. There's a lot of things we can add to technology to make it hard to be used in the wrong way. Seatbelts fundamentally were promoted by doctors who were treating head injuries. That's where it came from. They were just like, we need to stop all these head injuries. They're terrible. And seatbelts were the solution. So can you recouple essentially humans to algorithms and not treat them as though algorithms are automated in a sense that cars are automated? Can you not treat cars as though they're just sent off automated and we have no responsibility to the passengers in them? We really do. And we really need to look at algorithms as something that we've created and we need to take care of. We need to guide along the way. Anyway, the point I think really needs to be made in terms of Facebook's algorithms, as much as they say the algorithms are doing this or that, it's really Facebook management has been extremely weak. I mean, 2012 for me was a turning point when we started to see a lot of the Russian attacks in Eastern Europe. And then 2014-15 was an even more important turning point when they supposedly brought in this crack security team and this new CSO, and they're going to do all these great things for security. And they focused entirely, apparently, on bug bounties and encryption when the focus should have been on integrity. It was clear that in the run-up to that, there was a lot of integrity issues and the platform was being used to sway opinions because of integrity, not because of confidentiality. And if anything, the confidentiality emphasis allowed for pockets to generate even worse information where you couldn't see into it, so you couldn't stop it. And so saying it's the algorithm's going to take care of it, again, decouples the fact that the people who were supposedly creating the platform and creating the tools were saying somehow the algorithm was disconnected from them. It wasn't theirs and it wasn't working because it wasn't working, as opposed to they weren't making better algorithms.
And although sometimes this feels like news because there are new incidents all the time, and as you rightly say, the companies have known about this vulnerability for years and have done nothing about it.
Yeah. Not only did they know about it, I actually, I'm somewhat of an insider because I was actually in Silicon Valley for 20 years and I was in meetings, you know, inside Twitter. I would meet with engineers and they would tell me, I think I used to tweet about this even on Twitter, ironically, I would say, we'd go to a bar, we'd talk about how we're going to get rid of Nazis on the platform. They would go back into management circles and try to get that to happen. And they would just be told flat out, no, we're not going to get rid of Nazis. At the same time, they were kicking women off the platform for being disingenuous. Sex workers, for example, have to have an identity that protects their true identity so that they're not murdered or killed. I mean, it's just well known that people have reasons for having a secondary identity. Women were denied that right. Nazis were not. You know, it was just completely inequitable treatment coming from management for whatever political reasons. So it's not just that they knew this was a problem. They had a very political, very particular angle on it in the management circles there. And engineers were frustrated because they weren't allowed to fix it.
Well, I think fixing that problem is a good point on which we should conclude the discussion today. Davy, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a fascinating chat.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Infotagen podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, and featuring Davy Ottenheimer and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagen, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagen.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you until next time.